imagine for a few minutes here, imagine what it would be like if you, if each one of us, had full consciousness as a fetus and could now remember those sensations that you felt and had while you were a fetus in your mother's womb. We're not capable of that, but let's, for the sake of the beginning of this, let's just imagine that, that you're a fetus and you have full consciousness. You have language you can understand and communicate with yourself anyway. And let's ride that horse here for just a little bit. Your world is dark, and it's safe, and it's secure inside your mother's womb. You are bathed in warm liquid. You're cushioned from shock. You do nothing for yourself. You are fed automatically, and a murmuring heartbeat assures you that someone larger than you fills your needs. Your life consists of simply waiting. Your life consists of simple waiting. You are not sure what to wait for, but any change seems far away and scary. You meet no sharp objects, no pain, no threatening adventures. It's a rather fine existence in every way. And then one day, you feel a tug. The walls are falling in on you. The soft cushions are now pushing and beating against you, crushing you downwards. Your body is bent double, your limbs twisted and wrenched. You're falling upside down. For the first time in your life, you feel pain. You're in a sea of roiling matter. There is more pressure, almost too intense to bear. Your head is squeezed flat, and you are pushed harder and harder into a dark tunnel. Oh, the pain, noise, and then more pressure. You hurt all over. You hear a groaning sound, and an awful sudden fear rushes in on you. It is happening. Your world is collapsing. You're sure it's the end. You see a piercing, blinding light. Cold, rough hands pull at you. A painful slap. Congratulations, you've just been born. You've just passed through the birth canal, and you have been born. If we could have had a memory, we would have had something like that. As one man said, at birth, you're slapped on the backside, and it's all downhill from there. So interesting view of it. And then our lives begin. You know, birth itself is a struggle. Again, if we were conscious of it, that our experience would be something along that line. That this was taken from a book by Philip Yancey, Where is God When It Hurts, was the title of the book. You know, Jacob, you go to Genesis 47, coming off of this, you know, we come from this safe environment of our mother's womb, and then we're born into a world not knowing what we will face. None of us do. And Jacob is interesting. When Joseph, we know, had been sold into slavery by his brothers and had been in Egypt, and then eventually we know the story. His father Jacob and his brothers all came and they lived there. And Jacob comes, and Pharaoh, the ruler of Egypt, who Joseph served underneath, had the opportunity, and Pharaoh met Joseph's father. And we'll pick that up in Genesis 47:9. And Jacob said to Pharaoh, they've been introduced by Joseph. Jacob again, Joseph's father. And verse 8, Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage or sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. That's how Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, whose name the tribes of Israel bear, Jacob's name. But that's how he described his life. The days and years of my sojourning are 130. Few and evil have been the days of my life. That Hebrew word that's translated evil here is ra, R-A, is the spelling of it. It means bad. It's not evil from the standpoint of somebody doing evil. In this sense, this word here, it means bad, injurious, hurtful, unpleasant, giving pain. So Jacob said, I've had a lot of pain in my life. I had a lot of difficulty in my life, is what he's answering to Pharaoh. Well, we are born. We come down that canal, we're given birth, and then we set out on our life, those stages of life. And we learn. We learn, hopefully, we learn as we progress through life. But that learning, the experience of life, can be difficult, some much more difficult than others. And you look at being trained or being taught, as one gentleman I was reading explained, teaching, when we teach, teaching as a form of education is more academic and knowledge-based. Teaching is more academic and knowledge-based. Taking knowledge and depositing that in somebody else. Mr. Armstrong years ago, I think he used the illustration of like funnels being put in the heads of young people and just pouring information in there. Well, that's teaching. Training is more practical. Training is different from teaching. Training is more practical and skills-based or kind of job-focused. Training is participation, and life is participation. We are taught, yes, but life itself is training. It's participation. Life is training. Think of this. A boxer and a football player, they train. You don't teach them football. You may sit and see a chalkboard and be taught certain fundamentals about the game, the rules and regulations and all that, but they train. A boxer trains, and a football player trains, and many others do as well. Why? Why do they train instead of just be taught the game? Why do they train? The reason they must train is because they must know what it's like to be hit. They have to know what it's like to be hit. A boxer could be taught, you know, the moves, keep your guard up and this and that, the fine things of boxing. He could be taught, but until he's got in that ring and sparred and take a hit, he's not really trained. You have to be trained. You have to be able to take a hit. Life is taking hits. Life is taking hits. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews 5, speaking here of Jesus Christ, referencing Christ here in Hebrews chapter 5. And we'll pick it up in verse 5. Again, training is participation. You have to train. The boxer has to train. He has to be able to take a hit. He has to know what it's like to be hit. The football player has to know what it's like to have a 300-pound tackle hit you and put you down on the ground. But Hebrews 5 and verse 5, so also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, this will be the Father speaking, you are my son, today I have begotten you. As he says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, here referring to Jesus, in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear. Verse 8, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Jesus Christ lived this life. He lived on this same planet that we do, and Jesus took the hits of life as well, and some, as we know, much more severe than what we take. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. So Jesus, though he was a son, suffered. And he learned obedience by the thing that he suffered. Mike Tyson, who we wouldn't normally use as an example in sermons, we can learn something from Mike Tyson. You know, he was the world heavyweight champion. I don't know how far back that. It's got to go, what, 15 or 20 years now, if not longer? But just a brick house of a man. But anyway, Mike Tyson, the heavyweight champion of the world, made this comment. He said, everyone has a plan. He's speaking about boxing. He says, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. It changes everything. You enter the ring with a plan. I read the same thing. I think it was General Eisenhower referring to D-Day or war in general. It says you go into it with a plan, but then shots are fired and immediately things change and things are adjusted to it. But Tyson said, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face. Well, Mike Tyson could take a punch in the face. Let's look at just a little bit of Mike Tyson's regimen that he went through because he wanted to train. He wanted that championship. Well, in order to take a punch, Mike Tyson would arise at 4 a.m. in the morning for a 5-mile run. He would arise. He would do cumulative throughout that day, 2,000 sit-ups, 500 push-ups, and it just goes on from there. A rigorous training that he went through because he was participating in boxing and he had to be able to take a hit. He had to be able to take a punch. He said, discipline, one of the statements that Mike Tyson made is, discipline is doing what you hate and doing it like you love it. Doing what you hate and doing it like you love it, putting your heart into it. Well, that's life. Life is participation. We're being trained. We're being trained. You know, the victory, rather than as we know, as life shows us, the victory seldom goes to the man with his idle hands in his pocket. The victory seldom goes to the idle man who has his idle hands in his pocket. So we're born, as we read that, we imagine, as we did in that first part that I went through there, that we were conscious and we remember that, and everything was coming to an end. All of a sudden, this safe place where we were in, our mother's womb, that warm place, that constant sound of that thump, 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 the heartbeat, everything was good. And as it says, then the walls begin to crush in upon us. The dilation begins, and the womb, that which was so safe, begins to push you out that birth canal. You're being born. Life is that way for us. We're moving towards, brethren, a future birth into the kingdom of God. Well, you might liken us right now as being in that womb with all the difficulties that life brings us, but it's for a purpose. It's for a purpose. We're all familiar, brethren, I would imagine most are, with this Boeing jetliner, the 737 MAX, which has been grounded now for, I think, since last March or April, someplace in there. The 737 MAX, there were different versions of the 737 before the MAX came on. Well, they've had a lot of trouble with the MAX and cost several hundred people their lives. Well, let's look at that a little bit and see if we can pick up a few lessons from that. There was a focus when they came up with the 737 MAX, this new generation of the 737 that they end up calling the MAX. There was a focus on making the MAX fly as similarly as possible as the earlier versions of the 737. Because if it flew similarly, then they didn't have to retrain the pilots for that plane. And of course, that's an economic decision that they made. Well, in the design of the 737 MAX, in order to, part of the reason behind it is they were trying to come up with a plane that would use less fuel, which is common sense. They're trying to make it as inexpensive as possible to operate. Well, to use less fuel, the design of the plane called for larger engines, and those larger engines would be moved forward and higher than the previous model. So there was a replacement. The engines were placed a little bit differently on the 737 MAX. Well, the changes that they did affected how the plane handled as compared to the other generations of the 737 before that. And part of the issue that they came up with, in certain high-altitude conditions, the plane's nose would pitch up because of this additional thrust that it had. The nose would pitch up, risking a stall. Flying a stall is a sudden loss of force, which is called lift, that keeps the plane aloft. So if the nose is pointed up too much, it loses the force because it's now fighting not just to keep flying, but to climb. So what happens, the engineers, because of this tendency to do that, the engineers developed what they called a MCAS to manage that. MCAS is what they shortened as the acronym for that. I guess acronym would be the initials for it. What that stands for, that MCAS stands for Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System. So they knew this plane had this tendency to pitch up, the nose would pitch up. So they built into the system, they computerized it, where it would read that and then it would automatically adjust that nose back down. Because if you thrust up too much like that, you endanger going into a stall. Well, this MCAS, to shorten the way we'd put it, instead of saying each letter MCAS, this MCAS, it operated behind the scenes. It was computerized. It was built into the system, pushing down the plane's nose by moving that horizontal stabilizer that's on the tail of the plane, and it would bring the tail up a little bit and bring the nose down. And that's how they tried to compensate for that tendency. Well, we know that in March of this year, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 went down. It went down with a 737 MAX. I'll read a little bit of how that happened. It says, within seconds after takeoff, the instruments in front of the plane's captain went haywire. They went erratic. Digital displays for altitude, airspeed, and other basic information show dramatically different readings from those in front of his co-pilot. So they were getting these confused signals at this time. The controls in the captain's hand started shaking. I'll actually play a few of those if my phone will cooperate with me a little bit. The controls, the actual stick, what they call that the pilot hangs onto, they have built into it, it's called a stick shaker. And it actually vibrates that thing. It's telling you, hey, we got a serious problem here. It's built into it. Well, the stick shaker went off. That's a mechanical device that rapidly and noisily vibrate the control, the stick of the aircraft, to warn the pilot of an intimate stall. In other words, it's telling you that shaking says your nose is going up, you're going to stall out. And if it stalls out, it's just going to drop like a ton of lead. It's going to fall right down. So the message from the shaker meant the plane was climbing too steeply and was in danger of falling from the sky. Soon, a cascade of warning tones and colored lights and mechanical voices filled the cockpit. Everything was going on. So imagine yourself in that situation. Try to think about that a little bit, because I think sometimes, brethren, maybe our lives can seem that way to us. Listen for just a moment here to kind of help us catch on to this a little bit. Of the various warnings and stuff that a pilot is listening to in a plane. And I think sometimes people think their lives are coming undone in a certain way, and all these signals are going through, and we try to make sense of it. If I can bring it up here, I'll play a few of them. This is just different noises that are telling the pilot of situations.
Decision height.
Don't sink. Don't sink. Glide slope.
Plus 100.
Pull up.
Radio altimeter.
Wind shear. Wind shear. Wind shear. Sink rate. Glide slope. Too low. Flaps. Too low. Gear. Too low. Terrain. 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 Pull up.
V1.
Pull up.
Adjust vertical speed. Adjust. Climb. Climb now. Climb. Climb now. Climb. Crossing. Climb. Climb. Crossing. Climb. 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 Clear of conflict. Descend. 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 Crossing. Descend. Descend. Crossing. Descend. Descend. Descend now. Descend. Descend now. Increase. Climb. Increase. Climb. Increase. Descent. Increase. Descent. Maintain vertical speed. Maintain. Maintain vertical speed. Crossing. Maintain. Monitor vertical speed. TCAS test. Pass. Traffic. 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 TCAS test.
You get the point. Does your life ever seem like that to you? When things come and go in your life, it seems like sometimes all these alarms are going off, and you try to process them and see what we can do. What do I do to successfully keep this plane in the air? Or to successfully land it, whatever the case may be. All these bells and whistles are going off in that cockpit. Well, that's what happened here. All these things are beginning to go. Command, the captain shouted twice by using that word. There was a system in there that was supposed to adjust everything. So command, shouted the captain twice, trying to activate the autopilot. The response was another warning horn, just another noise. More noise came in. At that point, the powerful automated flight control system, the MCAS that I mentioned earlier, that was built in to bring the pitch of that nose down so it wouldn't go into a stall. At that, the powerful automated control system, MCAS, abruptly pushed the jet's nose down. It was simultaneously a computerized voice blared, which we just heard, "Don't sink, don't sink," because it was we were heading downward. The pilots wrestled with the controls, desperate to raise the noise of the 737. Three times the captain instructed the co-pilot, "Pull up." At the same time, a clacking warned the pilots that the plane was flying too fast. All this information being flooded in there. 4 minutes into the flight, the pilots touched the problem source, calling out left alpha vane, which is an external probe on the plane. And what was happening is erroneous signals from that malfunctioning sensor tricked the onboard computers, the MCAS, into believing that the jet's nose was angled too high. It was false information. It was saying the nose was too high, and it wasn't. So the MCAS, which was built into it, put the nose down, and then we read on here anyway, the plane crashed. Believing that Jet's nose was angled too high, causing the MCAS to push it down again and again. It was too late. Well, Flight 302 nosedived at nearly the speed of sound and killed all on board. Well, how often, brethren, if we can pull from that, as we go through this training that we call life, as we go through this training that we call life, how often do erroneous signals in our lives prompt us to make ill-advised response? We get signals, just like this left alpha vane was sending wrong signals. The plane's nose wasn't pitched up, but the readings were incorrect. Well, how often, brethren, do we get erroneous signals in our lives and prompt us to make an ill-advised response? And much of the time, those ill-advised, erroneous signals will arrive in the form of emotion or mood. Seldom will they arrive in the form of actual knowledge and fact, but they'll arrive in the form of emotion and mood, and we unfortunately react to it. It's not uncommon. Let's go back to a classic example of getting wrong signals, interpreting those signals wrongly. Let's go back to 1 Samuel. Of course, we're talking here about King Saul, the first king of Israel. We'll go to 1 Samuel chapter 18, and let's pick it up about verse 5. David is now, the young shepherd boy David, who will become king, is in Saul's service. 1 Samuel 18:5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he behaved wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So just accepted. David was a part of the administration, we might put it that way. Now, it had happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from that day forward. Saul took some information, right, and read it completely wrong, didn't he? Because of what the ladies were singing in the street, Saul interpreted that against him. Let's continue. Verse 9, so Saul eyed David from that day forward. And it happened the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall with it." But David escaped his presence twice. So here's Saul responding to some bad information and making a decision. Well, he's really responding not to bad information, the way he translated what he heard in front of him and the words that he heard. And he reacted in a way that made no sense. David was a loyal man in every way. We'll go back to the Boeing 737 MAX for just a moment here. 5 months before that crash that we just read about, 5 months before that, a 737 MAX plunged into the Java Sea under very similar circumstances to the one that we just read about. And, of course, that led to the grounding of that plane until they work out this MCAS system, which wants to keep pushing that nose down. Well, regulators, in their study of it, regulators have focused since on the crashes on that MCAS system and its reliance on a single sensor and Boeing's decision not to tell pilots about the new system, because they just thought they had enough training that the MAX was similar to the other planes enough that they could use their knowledge to make everything go well. Well, at the heart of the miscalculation, though, were Boeing's overly optimistic assumptions about pilot behavior and the way the pilots would handle it. Boeing assumed that the pilots trained on existing safety procedures should be able to sift through the jumble of contradictory warnings, which we heard some of those earlier, that the pilots would be able to sift through the contradictory jumble of warnings and take proper action 100% of the time within 4 seconds. That was the assumption that was made. Well, engineers assumed that the pilots would be able to almost instantly counteract the MCAS malfunction by executing a long-established emergency procedure for a similar problem. And they weren't able to do that. They were getting false information. Hebrews, let's go to Hebrews 12. What we can learn from this, brethren, that we are in this life, we are training. It's easy to lose sight of that, brethren, but it really is a training. This life is a training, and we shall, you know, at the return of Christ, be born into that family. But this is the time of training, the time of training as we live this life here. Hebrews chapter 12, we're going to look here again at Jesus and what he endured, what he went through. As he went through life, because remember, as Tyson said, everybody goes into the ring, everybody has a plan, then they get punched in the face. Well, let's go to Hebrews chapter 12, then verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. The race that is set before us is what you call life, and what I call life. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Isn't that the battle that people oftentimes face, becoming discouraged and weary and discouraged in your souls as we struggle through this life? Just like that, sometimes in this life, it can be like that baby when the walls, the mother's womb, begin to crush in upon him. All it was doing is pushing him towards birth, which is the things that we experience, are just pushing us towards that eventual birth into God's family. You have not yet, verse 4, you have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and he scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, there is chastening from God, yes, but if you endure chastening, look at it this way, if you endure those punches in the face, which life gives us, if you endure those punches, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us, as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. In other words, with a great purpose, to be born into his family. Verse 11, now no chastening seems to be joyful. None of those punches ever are joyful, are they? You know, your nose is aches, you've taken it right in the face and it hurts. And it's never pleasant. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been, what? Trained by it. Again, trained by living and going through life. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, which basically, a little note I put on the side, my margin here says, for verse 12, where it says, therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. It says, snap out of that posture of discouragement. Snap out of it. What are you discouraged about? You're simply moving towards birth. You're moving towards that birth. Snap out of that posture of discouragement and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all men and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. So that chastening, life has chastening in it. Some chastening come directly from God, where he may, for his particular reasons and lessons that he wants to incorporate into us, a direct chastening. But there is chastening just because there are other human beings in this world. and we live with other people. Life brings chastening upon us. And Hebrews 4, let's go back now to Hebrews 4, what I had mentioned earlier, and Hebrews 4 and verse 12, Hebrews 4, 12. And let us therefore, verse 11, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall after the same example of disobedience. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to his eyes of him to whom we must give account. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. So we are to hold fast. We are to take the punches and the hits and stuff and keep going. Now, some of the, it would seem, in this life that we live in this day and age, and perhaps it's not that much different from other times, epochs of time, I'm not sure. I think maybe it is, though. It seems like some of the biggest enemies of our time are emotion and convenience. Emotion and convenience. Where we make decisions based upon our emotions, and we make decisions based on convenience. Decisions based upon convenience. Let's define convenience. Convenience, the state of being able to proceed with something with little effort or difficulty. I'm sure it's been the inclination of man from the beginning of time, but so much more, I think, in our time because of the material world that we live in. I was just thinking about this morning. We were coming to church, and, you know, it's a little frosty out there this morning. It wouldn't be considered frosty to people in other areas who have much more severe weather than what we do. But my wife pushed a little button on the car, and I saw these four red lights come up, and I said, "What is that? What are you doing?" And because the car does more things than I even know what it does. But so these little red lights come up, and I said, "That's going to warm your seat up." So coming to town, it's, you know, a whole 32 degrees in Modesto, so we're suffering out here on the West Coast, folks. But anyway, all of a sudden, yeah, that feels kind of good. And we love that stuff. We're drawn that way. It becomes an enemy because we make decisions based upon convenience. We make decisions based upon convenience and so often emotion, so often emotion. And when the intensity that we once felt is no longer there and it gets difficult, then we have a tendency to find an alternative to that difficulty. We don't endure that chastening or that difficulty. As one young married man said to his young wife, and it's been said much more than one time, you can be sure, one young married man said to his young wife, when the intensity of the feelings had faded, they'd been married for a while, but the intensity was kind of fading, and he said, "I'm just not feeling this anymore. I'm just not feeling this anymore." And that would lead to a divorce because the intensity is not there anymore. It's just not what it was. So we don't speak of commitment in those things, do we? No, we speak of the feeling just isn't there anymore. So we make decisions based upon feelings and we make decisions upon convenience. I took this part here from a man, H.A. Ironside is his name. And the book or article, whichever it was, is called Act Like Men. Act Like Men. He says, "I love babies. I love babies. I think others ought to have as many of them as they wish. I think it's a delightful, enjoyable experience to watch babies grow up and to become little people, little men and women, adolescents and functioning persons. But you and I know that there are some things about little babies that are not very attractive. We humor them because they are babies. Here's a list of things. They are dependent and demanding. They are unable to feed themselves. They are unable to stay out of messes. They love to be the center of attention. They are driven by impulses, such as hunger, pain, and sleep. They are irritated when they're dirty, even though they're the ones that made the mess. And you got to clean it up. They have no manners, no control. They have little attention span, no concern for others, no abilities or skills." Now, these are natural things that are part of babyhood. But when you see adults with those characteristics, something tragic has happened. Something terribly unfunny. The Christian who is not interested in growing wants to be entertained. He wants a diet of milk when he cries for it. He wants his way, and he's going to get it, no matter how many he will have to disrupt to get it. You see, in order for a Christian to handle solid food, he has to have a growing, mature digestive system. He needs teeth. He needs to have an appetite that is cultivated over a period of time for deep things, for the solid things of God. Spiritual babies must grow up. Some of the most difficult people to live with are those who have grown old in the Lord, but haven't grown up in the Lord. So in life, we're supposed to grow up in Lord as we live. Whenever you see, continuing here from this article from H.A. Ironside, Act Like Men, whenever you see Christians fussing, quarreling about their own rights, complaining because they are not properly recognized, because people do not greet them as they think they should, because they do not get enough applause for what they do, put it down as the baby spirit coming out. The mature man in Christ is indifferent to praise or to blame. May God deliver us from our babyishness. In some churches, the minister spends half of his time trying to keep weak Christians quiet over little slights. If you're living for God, people cannot slight you because you will not let them. It will not make any difference to you. So a part of living this life, taking those punches and dealing with it and not allowing emotion to dictate our responses. Psalms 119, 165. Actually, Corey was in that verse, as I recall, 119, 165. Read the very same verse. Let's look at it again, where it says, "Great peace have those who love your law, and nothing causes them to stumble." The old King James says nothing offends them. But that peace comes from those who love the law, and nothing causes them to stumble. Because we have a humility about us. We know that we're all at different times and to different levels have stumbled and fallen and stepped on other people's toes with our words. And we understand that. And we don't allow those things to get underneath our skin. That's the working of God's Spirit. So Philippians chapter 4 indicates something along that same line. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 4. Philippians 4, 4. Again, this which we're living now is similar to the little fetus and recounting his journey from his mother's womb, where it seemed like the whole world was crushing in on him. But he stayed with it, and congratulations, as we read earlier, congratulations, you've just been born. You've just been born. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 4. "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God," which Mr. Bulgenza was speaking about, "and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding." Again, you can have a peace that is available to the people of God, a peace that passes all understanding, that you can maintain your equilibrium when all those bells and whistles and the shaker is going off in your control console, when everything is going haywire around you, you can still keep your course. You can still maintain your course. "And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you've learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do. The God of peace will be with you." So guidelines for living through this life. So as we look at this, brethren, we consider this and a congregation of people, the people of God and various congregations. I'd like to draw an analogy somewhat here from, again, it's in the corporate world, but certainly it is in the military. It's very common in the military, and it's called unit cohesion. That within those units, you have to have a cohesion. Particularly, well, throughout the military, it would be that way. We're all familiar with the Navy SEALs and the incredible things that those people do. The Army, I believe each branch of the military has one. The Army has, I believe, the Rangers, the Marines, some kind of special operation. I think they're called Raiders. But these would be groups. I really don't know how many men are in each group. It may vary. But there has to be a cohesion within that unit. That unit is tight. They don't just have a unit and then rotate people in and out of that unit. They are there. They become brothers in arms, as it were. There is a cohesion in that unit. Once this team is built and trust is established, the soldiers will begin to use words like we rather than I, because they see themselves as that unit and that cohesion of that unit. And then you strive to sustain that. Members of a cohesive unit have a strong bond to several things. I'll read those. Members of a cohesive unit have a strong bond to each other as well as to the mission. They're mission-oriented. They're mission-oriented because they know that unit is there for a mission. That unit will be sent out on a mission. So you have cohesiveness of that unit to carry out that mission, whatever it might be. It appears that from the study and research, and the military has poured millions of hours and millions of dollars into the research and establishing these guidelines. It appears that a soldier's ability to resist is a function of the capacity of his immediate primary group, his squad or section, to avoid any disintegration within that unit. As that unit holds tight, his ability to resist is strengthened. These are lessons from the military. Cohesion exists in the unit when the day-to-day goals of the individual soldier, of the small group with which he identifies, and of the unit leaders are congruent. They all match together, with each giving his primary loyalty to the group so that it trains and fights as a unit with all members willing to risk death to achieve, again, a common objective, a mission. They're mission-oriented. Out of the mutually shared hardships, life in our case, out of the mutually shared hardships and dangers are born an altruism and generosity that transcend ordinary individual selfish interest. But that cohesion of that unit in the military, that cohesion of the unit is absolutely essential. It is a unit that is formed and they stick together. What are some of the enemies of this cohesion? What are some of the enemies that has been discovered of this cohesion that the military strives to have and must have in order for those units to be successful in their mission? Dissatisfied people, the members of the unit, dissatisfied with the existing state of affairs, dissatisfaction with that. One who bears a grudge from a sense of grievance or thwarted ambition. You cannot have that in those units. They destroy from within. Again, dissatisfied with the existing state of affairs. One who bears a grudge from a sense of grievance or thwarted ambition. Some who are choking with self-pity. They cannot be in that unit. That cohesion was gone. Those choking with self-pity. People who are individuals, members of that unit, who are unsettled men. Men who are unsettled. Just something unsettled about them. Maybe come to peace with what they are or whatever, but they're unsettled. One individual, I remember seeing this sign on a desk probably 30 or 40 years ago over at the Masonic Hall. When I first went over there to see if we could find that as a place to rent, hold services, went in there and this lady had a sign on her desk just stuck in my mind, again, decades ago. It says, bloom where you're planted. And I thought, oh, that's really neat. That's simple. Bloom where you're planted. But so many people, and they can't have that in these units and have that cohesiveness, they don't like where they're planted. They're always dissatisfied, and they want to have been planted someplace else. So they're dissatisfied and destroys the cohesion of that unit. And unsettled men and willing to bloom where they're planted, and also certainly in this military setting, as in other aspects of life, those men who answer to their wives. It ain't going to happen. Those men who answer to their wives. The cohesion of that unit will be destroyed. You know, Mr. LeBlanc has mentioned, and I know people struggle through different things, I know that. And Mr. LeBlanc even last week was mentioning about having different visits with people. And you've seen it through the years where it could be the man or the woman, either one. But he has an interest, and his wife is a little resistant. And if you play that, at least in my mind, maybe I'm being too brief about it, but he's very interested, but his wife isn't down with it, so to speak, use the language, you know. So in other words, mister, you will obey God when your wife gives you permission. Oh, okay. Well, we won't see you. That's how it is. That's how it is. So you'll obey God when your wife gives you permission. Or wife, you will obey God when your husband gives you permission. Well, you can't do that. You can't do that. And the same thing within these units. That will be an enemy of the cohesion of a unit. Those dissatisfied with the existing state of affairs, one who bears a grudge from a sense of grievance or thwarted ambition, those choking with self-pity, unsettled men, unwilling to bloom where they're planted, and those who answer to their wives. Cohesion will be destroyed. I've mentioned this before, I think. George Washington, father said of our country, taken from a book called Valiant Ambition. A gentleman's his name was Nathaniel Philbrick. And he says of George Washington and Benedict Arnold, who both lived in the same time span. George Washington, known as a very God-fearing, righteous man, Benedict Arnold, known as a traitor. And this gentleman writes here, both were dynamic men of action with unquestioned personal courage. They were both courageous men, Washington was guided by an indestructible sense of honor. Reading about George Washington, that just leaps off the page at you. Washington was guided by an indestructible sense of honor. Benedict Arnold, on the other hand, was driven by a thirst for personal glory, and prerequisites that it could bring. Both men hungered for greatness, but to Washington, greatness meant subordination of the self to a cause. Again, cohesion of a unit, dedication to the cause. To Washington, greatness meant subordination of self to cause, learning from mistakes and mastering personal weaknesses. To Arnold, greatness meant the triumph of self over others, victory on the battlefield as a key to wealth, privilege, and the indulgence of personal appetites and for recognition. Big difference in the two men. So as we look at this cohesion that military groups strive for, the cohesion that any congregation of God would want and needs and should be, it has to do with commitment, has to do with dedication to the mission. It has to do with being able to take a punch, not react emotionally to it, for it is all one body. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. We know that. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And pick it up, I believe, in verse 12. Because all these things that we go through, that we experience, it is called life, and it's training. We are being trained. It's so easy to lose sight of that. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 12. For as the body is one and has many members, but all members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. So you think of that, and let's view that just a little bit from that same standpoint that we're talking about the cohesion of a military unit. We're talking about the same concept here, right? You're all dedicated to one thing. But in 1 Corinthians here, Paul is making it clear that to God, we are all part of a body. For by one Spirit, verse 13, for by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. So we have a body, but many members form that body, right? If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? Again, this unit cohesion we spoke of. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? Of course, that's foolish. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body just as he pleased. Bloom where you're planted. as a little caption I saw on that desk many years ago. But now God has set the members, each one of them in the body, just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? In other words, if the body was one big ear, it's not. It's all these different parts that make the body. But now, indeed, there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again can the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather, those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary, and those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor, and on our unpresentable parts we have greater modesty. Verse 24. But our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to the part which lacks it, that there should be no schism, unit cohesion, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Why we, this whole week, for Mr. Blanc, we encourage everybody, pray for Crystal. Pray for Crystal. That's one member. Crystal's a baptized member of the Church of God. She's a part of that body. She's a part of that body. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now, verse 27, now you are the body of Christ and members individually. So we are part of that body, and we are to have that unit cohesion within that body of Christ. So let's go to 1 Peter, and we'll end with the scripture. Go to 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 Peter 5. So we come through that birth canal where the walls collapse around us and pushes us out. And here we are, we're born. And then we come into life and we have all these bells and whistles going off around us. We're in that cockpit. And the very thing that we're guiding the plane with begins to shake and rattle on us. And this light's flashing, last light's flashing. And this one is saying, stall, stall, terrain, terrain. And we got to react. We got to do. It's called life. We're just living through life. We're living through life. 1 Peter chapter 5, and striving, brethren, in our own lives, and then striving for that unit cohesion. 1 Peter chapter 5, if I've got the right place here. Let's pick it up in verse 7. Casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you, when all those bells and whistles and the stick are shaking in your hand. Casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And he's going to send you erroneous information, just as that vane sent that erroneous information to the pilots of that plane. He's going to send erroneous information, especially if you're tuned in emotionally. Oh, you're dead in the water. Dead in the water. If your emotions guide you, you're dead. Emotions are wonderful. They're God-given. They're a spice kind of on life, but they're not what we get our nourishment from. They don't sustain us. So anyway, you see where to drop off. Casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour and whom he may deceive. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered, after you've been punched in the face, after you have suffered a while, he will perfect you, he will establish you, he will strengthen you, and he will settle you. And then you'll be born into a completely different life at the return of Jesus Christ.